Ms. Scott, the answer to the question.
No. So I've gone back and looked at the Wanaka Kiwi Holding Park submission, which the question relates to. Mm-hmm. The relief that they are seeking is specific to their land, and they quite specifically point that out in their submission. They describe three different lots, and they ask that the visitor accommodation overlay be extended over that site. They then move to the objectives and policies and a rule and seek some changes to enable visitor accommodation over their land. Your question in relation to whether that submission provides scope to create a de facto subzone for visitor accommodation, I don't believe it does. I just want to add to that because there's this another concept floating around, and I think that is where within the plan relief is provided for, and this relates to text more so than a zone, but this is something that's been addressed in other hearings, but the location of a specific provision that has been sought by a submitter, the fact that it may need to like locate over in a district-wide chapter, that doesn't mean there isn't scope for it to be pursued.
Thank you.
I will also address the earlier question about bringing in additional objectives and policies to achieve the desired outcome of a visitor accommodation subzone over the specific site in the legal advice.
Question, follow-up question. While vis-à-vis the submitter, there might be scope to make changes in another chapter. Does this panel have that scope, or is that a matter of us referring the matter on to the hearing panel with jurisdiction over the relevant other part?
Where this panel is recommending an additional rule or objective or policy that is specific to a rezoning request, council's position is there is scope for you to make that recommendation. If this panel is making a recommendation where the text requires change, so it's essentially readdressing something that's already been addressed, then it needs to be the internal recommendation.
So I said, where it's making a text change specific to a particular rezoning,
yes,
then that's our baby. But if it's a broader effect, or potentially broader effect, that's a matter we need to communicate internally.
That is correct.
You have the floor, Commissioner.
My last question, Mr. Barr, is that, again, were we to support broadly what the submitter seeks, but not the controlled activity aspect of it, where would that leave us?
In what context do you mean, in terms of, not obviously not in terms of the scope of...
So say we supported it, say we found in support of everything that was being proposed, except that we felt on the balance of the facts and the rest of the provisions of the zone, a restricted discretionary status was the appropriate one, not a controlled activity one. Would that be an avenue open to us, or would that lead us to necessarily recommend rejection of the submission?
This does relate to an overall concern or matter that I have with people wanting to rely on future resource consents to solve their problems and getting the zoning now. It depends. I think it's a case by case situation of whether of the degree of certainty that the panel can have with the information supplied with the submission. In this case, for this submission, the submitter's provided a fair degree of information in terms of a natural hazard assessment, and I think it was on my mind, if I didn't recommend it in my report, that I think the restricted discretionary activity status would be appropriate because of the hazards. So in this case, I think restricted discretionary would be more appropriate.
Yeah, but accepting that, the question was, do you think, based on what the submitter has asked for, that's an outcome we could safely and soundly conclude? Or would we be safer concluding we might have supported this if the request was for the restricted discretionary, but because it was the controlled, we recommend rejection of the submission? So again, it's floating between you and Mr. Scott about scope and how much freedom we have, bearing in mind the need to treat all the submissions on a broadly consistent basis.
If you're able to, if I was able to recommend something in between, controlled or it doesn't happen, or controlled or non-complying, which is probably not something the submitter's looking for, I think restricted discretionary would be my recommendation. But it's with Ms. Scott in terms of the
So what you're saying is that if we were to reject the submission, the default would become non-complying based on the underlying zone provisions. The submitter sought controlled, and so therefore anything between non-complying and controlled might be an accepted part territory. Is that what you're saying?
If that's possible, from Ms. Scott's advice, what I'm saying is, yes, clearly what I'm saying is if there's no subzone, then it's non-compliant.
Yeah.
They've asked for control, but I'd be more comfortable with the restricted discretionary because of the hazards.
Ms. Scott, over to you. So this is where a submitter has asked for a specific activity status. In this case, a controlled activity. If we were to recommend rejection of the submission and the council agreed, the activity being sought would default to non-complying using the underlying zone provisions. And so this is a question of whether between what would become non-compliant control, we have the ability to then find something in the middle or not.
You say agree that you do.
We do. Okay. I have another question, thank you.
Could I ask a follow-up question on that one? I'm coming from a point of not having read through in detail that the Commissioner Monroe has, but I just like to make sure that the ground has been covered. That if we are in a situation like that where we are recommending a different activity status, whether the plan provisions already right in the relevant assessment criteria or whether it's something else that we have to turn our minds to. So going back to Commissioner Monroe's specific question about that slide, if the status did change on our recommendation, are there sufficient provisions to assess something as a restricted discretionary rather than control, because the matter for assessment would change.
If you wanted to change the activity status from, say, controlled as requested, but you're happy to accept the submission or recommend accepting the submission, but it would be restricted discretionary, you'd need to modify that. And if my understanding that can be done as a consequential change in the overall concept or within the spectrum of the relief sought, saying that if you wanted to make it discretionary, but you wanted to add assessment matters generally for that land use.
Can I add that the submission in its proposed controlled activity rule lists matters of control? They may well be a good starting point, but obviously need to be looked at through the lens of the restricted discretionary activity. But yes, they would be required as well, alongside the rule. Thank you.
That might make, in terms of the extent to which the panel has to step into the unknown or the area of uncertainty in terms of what exactly is consequential in an RDA, just what exactly, what matters are reserved, that might push us more towards a full discretionary position. being a safer option. Mr. Barr?
Well, that's right. I talked about that this matter quite a bit in my rural hearing evidence, and where you have, you know, the discretionary activity status is better suited for activities with a potential wide range of effects or a wide range of matters to address. Restricted discretionary is better where you, let's say for a, you know, a performance standard related to a building setback, obviously where you know you have, there's a fair degree of certainty what the impacts of the breach are going to be, whereas informal airports or a building in the residential building in the rural zone could have dozens of matters to address, so you wouldn't want to pigeonhole yourself through a restricted discretionary or that.
Commissioner Hudson, I have a
Thank you, that's all.
Commissioner McLean, this is a long discussion of Kiwi Park, but
no, it's been very interesting.
Any additional contribution from yourself on Kiwi Park?
Crack on.
So we're now at Studham Road, Section 4. And to be read in light of your rebuttal acceptance or recommended acceptance of the successors and title of 100 Studham Road. Commissioner Monroe.
I've got no questions regarding the Blennerhassett request. I do have a question on the Willow Ridge request, though, so I can wait until we get that one.
Okay, well, we'll do them in terms of...
Yep.
Mr. Barr, it occurred to me on the same logic that you've applied to your rebuttal evidence on the Anderson Family Trust, not quite the same, but there are a series of lots that are carved up on the north side of West Meadows Road where the same lot is in two zones. And my question, and this was actually what my question yesterday to Ms. Banks about the capacity of that road, how much is too much, was driving at. It occurred to me that pulling the Hardy LDR zone down on the north side, there's one, two, three, four properties to the right of Ruby Ridge and two to the left of it on the north side. What would your view be about those? Because it strikes me that that doesn't seem a very sensible boundary for the zone.
I agree. I think my rebuttal was purely focused through the lens of the Anderson Family Trust evidence. Clearly I'd have to refer back to Ms. Banks to see what the impact that would be in terms of higher density and traffic issues, because that's the reason overall for not being able to support the Willow Ridge's submission wanting the larger parcels of land rezoned. But I agree, it's the same argument, but I was purely looking at it through the Anderson submission and the rebuttal.
Yes, the Anderson submission clearly doesn't raise, and the property next to it doesn't raise the traffic issues because, as they say, they access Studham Road. But so I think that what I would write down is, in principle, yes, subject to traffic. And I suppose the question is, how big are those lots that have been divided?
I think they're about 800 metres squared. The lots adjacent to Ruby Ridge around us.
So if the lot with the zone line through it is that at most you're going to get one extra each for each lot, aren't you?
If that.
Some of them it will make no difference.
That's right. There could be three more houses, four more houses at the most on plan. Yeah. I think that's something I can address in my reply.
If you could, please.
Anything from you?
Yes, please. Mr. Barr, in relation to your rebuttal on 100 Stubborn Road and your reconsidered opinion regarding rezoning, I just would like to understand whether you're satisfied that resource consent is required, the subdivision will require consent, and depending on the actual zoning, resource consent may be required too. So the first thing, the subdivision will require consent. Are you satisfied that the assessment process and the assessment criteria are sufficiently broad for the council to be able to take into account traffic effects? In relation to 100 Stubborn Road, we're only talking about a small number of potential additional dwellings, but as this sort of follows on from the discussion with Ms. Banks about at what point these issues over traffic generation are a zoning issue versus a resource consent issue.
I don't think you could rely on the subdivision chapter to look at traffic generation. I think the subdivision chapter is more of a checks and balances in terms of your performance standards in and out of each lot, safety from intersections, safety to access, and the standards which the infrastructure is built. I think something like traffic generation would need to be assessed at the time of either of the rezoning. For these urban, it's not the same for a rural development, but certainly for a development of low density residential land.
So that's one of the constraints in your opinion then, that even if other factors rezoning might be justified, that where you've had advice that on traffic grounds there's a potential problem, that's been across rather than a
check. That's right. And there's been other submissions, the one on Terranova Place, for instance, Ms. Banks suggested that there needs to be some treatment for the access or treatment within the site in terms of a... but to me that's more of a checks and balances matter that can be sorted through a subdivision without relying on something that hasn't happened yet. Whereas in this case, because it's a traffic generation issue on the council's road, on the council's infrastructure network essentially, then it would need to be addressed. I think it needs to be addressed as part of the zoning change. Resolved as part of the zoning change.
Can you just help me then with the council's development contribution policy? With things like subdivision, at what point do DCs kick in? Do you know? I don't have any background on the your policy.
Development contribution.
If you're going from one lot to two, I wouldn't imagine there's any requirement to pay traffic related contributions.
No, it's all a set fee, and the development contributions are set annually. So the council can't levy against a specific development through development contributions. That goes back to my statement I made in my summary, where I said that the council accepts the level of intensity and the level of effects within the urban growth boundary,
yes.
It's up to the council essentially to invest in infrastructure to make it work. That's also one of the reasons that I was being reluctant to accept rezoning submissions to extend the urban growth boundary where there's question marks about that. And in this case, because Ms. Bangs has concerns about additional transportation effects, and because I can't say that right now the council's plan to upgrade the intersection of Sutton Road with Cadrona Valley Road, that might alleviate Ms. Bangs' concerns, then I'm bound to rely on her advice that the traffic generation along that road has reached a point.
Interesting dilemma, really.
And it is.
We did discuss it with her, and you were there for that discussion.
It is. I mean, we still get to hear from Willow Regional Trib Road Holdings, who are the same development company, in terms of their submissions. A lot of them were on the fringes. Essentially, I've gone fishing in my evidence in chief in terms of perhaps a structure plan would resolve this issue, perhaps some specific evidence on this matter, but we haven't got it yet. So I don't think the door's closed to this issue, but I think over and above what the council's accepted at this point in time, we need to see more evidence that there's an alternative or that it would be appropriate.
Would you say that the obviously the place of Willow Ridge and Roger Holdings, you're dealing with one entity, considering 182, potentially 182 sites, whereas this you're dealing with several entities, that complicates the issue so much more?
It does. And I think sort of digressing a little bit, but the Alpine Estates submission, the Orchard Road Hold submission, we've identified issues, but we didn't close the door. I think the structure plan process might be able to sort these issues out. Whereas potentially that's also one of the reasons why I'm not supporting the rezoning of the Grandview, the subdivisions at the eastern corner of Lake Hawe Settlement.
While I remember, just to alert you, Ms. Scott, overnight I had a communication from the admin team from Mr. Darrell Rogers, who's, I haven't figured out yet whether he is acting on behalf of Ms. Batson or in relation to his own further submission, but related to the rural residential zone in Hawea. Prior to the last week of hearing, he suggested that he might file a further brief of evidence, and the message back was that he would need a leave from the chair. He's now made application for leave, and attaching his piece, it appeared to me to be more in the nature of a submission. It also consistently mislabeled Mr. Barr as Mr. Glenn Davis, which was interesting. And I've told, for your information, through the admin team, I've told Mr. Rogers that I will accept his submission as a submission, not as evidence, on condition that he removed certain unfortunate implications, if not outright suggestions, impugning Mr. Barr's integrity. So long as it was in our hands by 1 p.m. on Monday. He's appearing, I think, either Wednesday or Thursday next week.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. We can respond.
Indeed. But having raised, I thought I'd alert you to it.
Thank you.
The The other question is, you said other follow-ups, but greetings. You said that the issue, the question Commissioner Hudson raised about subdivision didn't arise in relation to rural subdivisions. My recollection is that the subdivision rule, by the end of by Mr. Bryce's reply version, the subdivision rule for rural lifestyle zones was practically identical to the default subdivision rule for urban subdivisions. I think there was one additional matter that related to the location of building platforms. So when you said rural, do you really mean rural or the rural zones collectively?
I meant the rural zone on its own, essentially. I meant where you have a discretionary or non-compliant activity status subdivision for something in the rural zone that was other than farming, whether it be a subdivision associated with a land use consent for a commercial activity or a residential building for residential activity. That's the context I mean. Sorry, meaning that you had full discretion to look at traffic generation and that sort of thing.
Now, go on to Willow Ridge. Willow Ridge, Studham Road. Councillor Road.
Mr. Barr, excuse me. Seems that the overriding technical concern with this particular submission is the net traffic burden at Cardrona Valley Road intersection. My first question is, of all the properties that derive access from West Meadows Drive, has the PDP proposed to grant additional development that could lead to more traffic than the ODP?
Yes. The large areas of greenfield land, I think, are zoned rural residential under the ODP. They've been zoned low density residential. In terms of the, while you need a restricted discretionary activity resource consent, the low density residential zone has introduced the concept known as the gentle density rule you might be familiar with from the residential hearings, and the provisions to make residential flats easier to establish because they are only subject to the size of the building, not that they're attached to some to an interior building. That will make them easier to establish on site. So
do you think Ms. Banks may have unintentionally compromised her analysis by assuming the proposed rezoning that the council has proposed won't have any additional traffic problems at the intersection of concern to her, but that this submitter will? Because it seems remarkably coincidental that every other bit of upzoning the council seeks won't create problematic traffic generation, but this submitter will.
Head of his banks, she wasn't involved with the council when we notified the plan, so she might have raised similar concerns with the level of traffic generation perhaps onto that road, but from her perspective being asked to look at this now and through her with what she can offer in terms of her expertise, that's a cumulative issue that she's identified.
Well, let's certainly not about criticising Ms. Banks, but let's say we reach an unsatisfactory situation, however we've got there, where the PDD is simultaneously promoting a lot more traffic on an intersection of concern to an engineer that's not being acknowledged,
whereby a submitter that's asked for some additional traffic on that intersection is being told that that's not satisfactory. And so how do we proceed? Do we recommend that none of the upzoning on West Meadows Drive should proceed at this time on the basis of inferred traffic problems with the intersection?
None of the upzoning, meaning including the council's?
Because the evidence is there's a capacity problem at that intersection, and it seems there's a whole bunch of potential upzoning that doesn't seem to have been included in that analysis. So it would be nice to know where we go from here.
Well, Ms Banks' assessment was made on the proposed district plan, not the operative district plan, and the changes relative to those.
So she's assumed all the PDP zones get approved?
Yes.
And the Willow Ridge submission is over and above that?
That's correct.
But is that the correct way to do it? From a planning perspective, when we're not supposed to be assuming the council's proposed rezonings are inherently superior to what a submitter might ask for.
I'm not entirely sure how to answer that because no one's asked for downzoning. There's been no submissions for a downzoning on that land. It's only an upzoning.
But it's a matter, I think, of the technical analysis of saying there is capacity on the road. The council's picked winners of who should get that capacity. Bad luck Willow Ridge, which is, I think, not an unreasonable way of characterising where Willow Ridge finds itself. And so how do we deal with that?
I think we wait to hear their submission, if they bring any technical advice along to that.
Well, they'll have difficulty given they haven't pre-circulated any expert evidence.
That's correct.
Putting that issue aside for us to nod through.
Sorry.
Carry on if it helps answer questions.
I was just thinking, Commissioner, that they could have opposed that part of the notified zone, and I don't believe they have.
No. They might have assumed, given the council's proposing upzoning itself, there wasn't a problem.
Yes, but the evidence that Mr. Barr has just given to you is that the problem has come from the notified version, along with the additional being sought. If there was a further submission opposing what the councillor notified, that means that both would have been assessed by Ms. Banks.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I understand that. But one question in between those two is whether the council's proposed rezoning consumes all of the available capacity, or whether, for instance, the Willow Ridge submission could have been subject to an accept in part based on whatever gap there is between the council's rezoning and the capacity of the intersection, which again doesn't seem to have been acknowledged or addressed. But putting that aside, if there's agreement, and I think, Mr. Barr, in your analysis, you're quite fair to acknowledge there were some planning and urban form benefits to the zoning that was sought. It was really just this intersection issue. In light of our requirement under Section 32 to consider all the feasible options that might find the most appropriate outcome, is there an argument that awarded the zone subject to a site-specific rule requiring the intersection had to be satisfactorily fixed? Non-complying activity subdivision until XXX?
Yes, that wouldn't be difficult to do procedurally. You could just have that in the subdivision chapter,
would that be more effective than just rejecting the zone outright?
It would be. Yes, I agree that it would. What I was thinking ahead to was the obligation of that intersection being upgraded in terms of financial. If there's a trigger point in the plan saying that the subdivision can't happen until the intersection's upgraded, we need to be clear that is it the developer who's responsible for upgrading the intersection or the council?
Well, what's really interesting would be what would happen if Willow Ridge did a subdivision before any of the PDP upzoning that the council's proposed happened. Because it could well be that a lot of these gentle density provisions you've talked about don't get taken up. And in fact, there is lots of capacity for Willow Ridge's subdivision.
Mm.
And yes. So then one finds oneself having to think through some requirement at a certain point of trigger or saturation for the intersection to be sorted.
It would, and you'd need a quantified trigger point as to when that needs to happen.
Which we don't have.
No, I don't have, sorry.
No, well, don't apologise. It's just the nature of the process. Okay, look, that's helped clarify the issues. I don't know that it's helped lead to what the answer might be. What I will ask, though, is just in terms of the map shown on page 15 of your evidence, which shows the submitter's proposed rezoning,
mm-hmm.
and what we see on that is if we go to the western end of West Meadows Drive, there's a very clear north-south cadastral line that goes up north, and it's the back of some River Ridge properties, and it continues down southwards, and we see it is the corner of the area proposed to be rezoned by the submitter as it goes from being a horizontal east-west line to the sort of 45-degree diagonal. Are you with me there?
Yes.
And then if we go down to the combined plan that's been shown on page 16 of your evidence, that's got a different underlying cadastral base because that north-south cadastral line at the end of Meadows Drive doesn't continue south. I think that map's lost a bit of what the submitter sought, because we've now effectively, if you see where the boundary between the east-west line and the diagonal line of the rezoning goes, that's now been shifted eastwards. Do you see what I'm talking about, or do I need to?
I think.
Shall I point it on a map somewhere?
No. I see what's happened. Yes, there's been a subdivision. There has been an allotment created at the end of West Meadows Drive.
Okay, so I don't think we need anything further from you other than just agreement that where the line would be were we to agree with the submission. We'd have to make some amendments to that diagram we've drawn. Yeah, it would push out to the west a little bit, yeah.
Thank you, yeah.
Okay, no, it's one. I'm going to put this please.
I had a question bouncing off the question I posed to Ms. Banks about how much is too much, effectively. She's considered the combined picture and said that's too much of a demand on West Meadows Road as currently configured at the intersection. And I said, well, and I have to admit that bouncing off Commissioner Monroe's point, that I took the PDP position as a given, but I asked her how much beyond that, assuming there is some capacity left, and her answer may be there's none, but if assuming there is some, how would you recommend we would divide that capacity between these two submitters? Because we can put aside 100 Studham Road and the one next to it, the Anderson property and its neighbour, because they're not actually using that capacity. We then have two submitters seeking upzoning. If there is some traffic capacity, and traffic is in fact the only constraint, but not enough to support the whole of the relief, how do we divide it up? This is
I think Willow Ridge wants the biggest chunk. That's including
yes, we know that.
That's including the land, which is might not have too much of a material effect, just on the northern side of West Meadows Drive, opposite Ruby Ridge, but I, off the top of my head, I can't offer any suggestion how to divide up in terms of apportioning some sort of obligation for alleviating the issues with traffic generation between those two sites, or between those two submitters who want their respective land rezoned?
Well, given that we're talking about a hypothetical pending this bank's surfacing, can I leave it with you and council team generally to bounce off that answer, and if there is indeed some traffic capacity, we'll call the where we started with those six part lots, we'll call them low-hanging fruit. But the question is, because that's obvious in terms of a logic of zone, but if we were to move beyond that to utilise any additional capacity Ms. Banks identified, how we might robustly allocate that.
Thank you.
And so it may be a non-issue if Ms. Banks says there is none, but we'll see.
Could I just add to that the reverse clarification that Ms. Banks has actually taken into account that the PDV is proposing whatever additional traffic generation it proposes over the ODP. This confirmation she has actually already factored all that in, as will happen.
Thank you.
Sir, I had a follow-up question on
certainly
that.
Certainly, please proceed.
Mr. Bauer, I actually wondered whether, in your opinion, given that not all subdivision was going to occur simultaneously, whether it would be an issue anyway.
Perhaps yes, in some respects perhaps the answer is the same, and that why we haven't included residential flats in our PCM outputs at this stage as well, because it's something that can happen, but it's up to the circumstances of the landowner, and it's not something we wanted to leverage off in terms of propping up our DCM outputs. But in this case, if everybody created a residential flat along that road, then it would have a potential effect on the traffic generation as well.
Yes, I understand that, but what I'm getting at is that in your experience as a planner, is that a credible scenario? Or, I mean, aren't we looking at progressive increase in the level of development?
Yes, I mean, I think it's credible, especially over the life of the next 10 or 15 years.
I think you need to clarify that. Is it progressive development credible, or is it all at once credible?
A progressive development is more credible. Mm. And I can say that given the growth projections that the Upper Clutha has, which is in Mr. Osborne in my supplementary evidence on the dwelling capacity outputs and housing capacity. So I think there's a likelihood of it occurring.
Well, it seems from what we heard from the Banks that intersection is going to need to be upgraded anyway. So how much more of an issue arises from the amount of land that's in question here, and is it more a question of the timing of the amount of time it takes before that critical point is reached for the upgrade?
That is a fair point. And if the council's planning program for the next 3 years included an upgraded intersection, we might have been able to arrive at a different recommendation. So I think it's something I should take away and give some further thought, talk to Ms. Banks, talk to Mr. Glasner, and see if there's some sort of alternative to assist.
And the nub is, again, who pays for it? Because the given the impact of sweet pipes to digress onto State Highway 6, and then became an arm wrestle between Transit Council and the developer as to when that trigger point was reached, and the discussion being that should it be cancelled because we've upgraded the PDP, should it be developer because they think they benefit, or should it be on the unfortunate individual who happens to ask for the request at the right time when the trigger point is reached? And that, if you wouldn't mind getting some clarity on that, that would be fantastic.
Well, I can probably answer that now, and that it would have been simpler if there was one landowner wanting development rights or upzoning off one road, some with one street, and then it's quite easy to have a trigger point or a structured plan in your plan saying when this happens, or when it reaches a threshold, this is going to happen, and that's in the operative plan for Shot Over Country and the roundabout on State Highway 6. Where there's multiple landowners, you can imagine the response I would have got from Willeridge if I'd said that they can have the rezoning if they pay for the upgrade of the intersection onto Cadrona Valley Road, because it's already been used by a lot of other people, so I didn't bother. But that essentially comes back to, does the council want to accept that level of defeat, and therefore the council, to be on the council to upgrade that intersection, because there's so many people using it anyway, and it's not fair to even though they are increasing what the council's promulgated through its PDP, it's sort of commensurate to the other effects on that road already. It might not be fair to leverage that off one submitter, so to speak. So it might just be a case of accepting that it needs upgrading and relying on the council to do so. But perhaps the trigger point could be there, but I think the onus might just have to be on the council to ensure the upgrading happens, and that would need to be clear in any policy framework or rules.
And potentially in this case I do agree with you, and I don't have to imagine, because when I did suggest to Willeridge that they should become responsible for the upgrade of the intersection of State Highway 6, I know exactly the response I got.
And that was a result that they own and have master plans, so yeah. For it here.
But in here it's, but it is, it's an interesting question to have some sort of discussion. Okay,
rocking on. Next one, Ian Weir. No, both of
us. You're looking to your right.
Okay.
No, thank you.
The one thing that it does, and it's used it a couple of times through Miss Banks' evidence, is without modelling information, she opposes the zoning request, so therefore, presumably, with on modelling information. So it's just a lack of information as opposed to, and that goes to the same.
That's right. That's, well, yes, essentially.
Same point.
Is this case you described as fishing, having run this up the flagpole, you regard the onus being on the submitter to come and support their provision with further information, further analysis, to advance the matter?
Well, it helps to obviously get their side of the story, and if they can provide that with some qualified information, it helps everybody.
Right. Next one, Deborah Brent.
Thanks. Good on you for trying to interpolate what the submitter might have meant. In the absence of specific clarity on what the submitter meant, despite your best efforts to do so, do you still think it's safe for us to consider further, or?
No.
That was my question.
That was a good answer.
No,
we said it was a good answer. Stop talking.
Thank you.
Quit while you're ahead. The Drayton. Nothing on Drayton. Jobson, where of course you've changed position following the clarification in the staff report. Then the evidence of Mr. White. I have a question that also arises in relation to Beresford, but somewhat more sharply. What is, and this might also be a matter for legal comment, where, as here, you have a row of landowners and you have a submission seeking upzoning by only some of those landowners, is there an issue that they are, the submitters are actually speaking for, as I say, only some of the landowners who might not actually want or that their land be upzoned, given the rating implications of upzoning? Like, one answer might be, well, they could have lodged a further submission in opposition, which in reality is council of perfection in my view. Be heroic that an individual landowner would pick that up if the submitters hadn't bothered to talk to them about it. So is there an issue we should be concerned about, or should we be relaxed? And the reason I say it arises in relation to Beresford is, of course, Mr. Beresford is acting on behalf of 1,000 landowners, some of whom are not even known. He's very clear that he's not speaking for them all, but he's seeking to fundamentally change the nature on which the land is held.
The bigger issue to me is the Makarora lifestyle zone. Obviously, that's been downzoning.
Yes.
The implications of that are quite significant for those landowners. In terms of that, and in terms of process, I probably have to defer to Ms. Scott. I think we all know the answer. Just offhand, though, the council, I think, before it, or at the same time as it released the summary of decisions in October 2015, we did make available online a map of the rezoning areas.
And very good, very useful.
Over and above what we're obliged to do in terms of Schedule 1. So that's just about as, and anything more than that, you seem to be prejudicing a submitter. If the council got involved and told somebody that somebody had made a submission on their land, it's a bit like inviting people to make a submission on a notified resource consent. No?
Are you having a conversation with yourself?
There was an answer in there somewhere, sir.
No, Scott.
I think it's something to throw into the mix. It's relevant, but it's not an answer in terms of whether a rezoning is rejected or not. Good practice would be for the submitter who is leading the charge to seek approval and provide that evidence to the panel as to landowners' positions.
Difficult with 1,000.
Many of whom you don't know who they are.
My answer was a general one.
But this is, of course, the question I'm going to ask Ms. Stephen. But are there any legal principles that you're aware of, Ms. Scott? Other than the obvious one that if they didn't like it, they have the opportunity to further submit?
Yes, well, the RMA does specifically provide for that process, and that is why it is there. There is matters of fairness, natural justice, etc., which may have some relevance. I'm not aware off the top of my head of a case that is specific on that point, particularly not specific to the Beresford example.
Which might be unique on a whole range of levels.
Mm. Yes. But I'm sure Ms. Stephen is thinking about that.
Anyone else on Jobson?
Thanks. Terranova, is that a public road or a private? Sorry.
It's a private right of way.
It's a private right of way. I'm trying to think through, and I'm still trying to get my head around the balance of where the subdivision restrictions might reasonably and appropriately start and stop. If rezoning goes ahead, and the person who owns the back lot goes first, how would the private right-of-way be upgraded as identified as necessary by the plan? Given there's a whole bunch of different landowners, perhaps they all need to agree before anyone can do anything anyway, so maybe the rule should be they have to all be planned together. So again, it's the administration of the relief sort. How would it actually happen?
Under the operative transport chapter, there would be a trigger point that, I'm not sure of the exact figure, but once an access was going to serve more than 12, let's say 12 lots or 10 lots, there would be a requirement, there would be an expectation in
right.
the rule framework that it would be, have a 20 metre wide legal width and that it would be formed and vested in council. I think I foreshadowed this in either my evidence in chief or my summary that it's going to fall on some unlucky person. If they don't get together and develop it comprehensively, it's going to fall on some unlucky submitter at one point to be obliged for that to happen. And I don't think that's particularly fair, but at the same time, I was reluctant to insert a specific rule into the plan addressing this matter because it might result in a district plan that's too big.
Sorry.
If we did that for every site, so...
So you've effectively, the first mover principle is pretty much what you've described, which happens everywhere, which is the person who wants to go first ends up having to pay. But I understand the PDP transport section is for a future stage, so we have no idea what might or might not apply. So how do we now have any confidence that the transport upgrade identified as necessary to support the zoning can happen without the insertion of a potentially administratively inefficient site-specific rule? So how do we get out of what seems to be a cycle?
We are planning to notify the transport chapter by around August. So if you haven't written your recommendations before then, that might help. But in the absence of that, there's nowhere for you to provide support, and that is there.
Unless we supported the relief with an additional rule.
That's right, that's what I mean.
Applying to that block, saying as soon as any more units are proposed, the road has to be upgraded.
Which would probably hopefully encourage the landowners to do something comprehensively rather than under the operative plan leave it for the unlucky person who triggers the 12th.
Well, that might be a reason why it's a good idea rather than a bad idea, but...
Depending on who you are, yes.
Can I ask the supplementary for that, please?
Sure.
Doesn't that same exact same question lead to multiple submissions?
Where there's infill and it's off a where there's an infill type, well, not a brownfield, but where there's upzoning of existing of multiple allotments. It depends. It just depends on the configuration. This one's clearly going to jump out because it's 12 properties shared by one private road, rather than a whole block with separate accesses onto the road.
But would that same principle that Mr. Munro's not talking about, that you could actually look at and approve or disapprove depending on a condition?
Yes, you could. You could, and that's where you could go. But I didn't go there. I didn't mention it in my evidence, but I didn't go there because I didn't think it would be very efficient to insert a rule just for that.
Yep.
Because when you look at it on, take a helicopter view of the plan, and the zone, if there's something like 22,000 houses in the low density zone across the whole district, you know, a rule like that just for 12. So I'm relying on a transport chapter that doesn't exist yet, but I was referring to the operative transport chapter that at some point there's going to, you know, and the plan will ensure an environmental outcome, but unfortunately it's going to fall on one person to, but having said that, this is about addressing the relief sort, which was the upzoning and not the arrangement of the right of way and how that works between those landowners.
Yeah. agreed and carrying on following the principles of natural justice that we just mentioned, you know, that the that has surely you have to take that into account as well. Just, I don't expect an answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could I just seek clarification, Mr. Barr, on that? In talking about this 12 lot rule, do you know the background of the consenting? It makes me wonder whether that's why there are only 12. You know, that you built to that standard so that you did not have to create a public road.
Probably not. I mean, at the moment, they're all about the 4,000 square metre mark, which is the operative zoning, well, in the proposed zoning, sorry, of large lot. I mean, large lot residential B, which is 4,000 metres squared. I mean, it's not uncommon in these sorts of situations, even where they exceed the rule, for the subdivider to ask that it still remain as a private road and that it can have a smaller carriageway, and that's just things you work through the subdivision.
So it's just a coincidence.
Yes, I think so.
My clarification is that you said you were relying on stage two to sort it out. I think stage two transport section. Go back to the ODP. As I understood you, the ODP would create the first mover issue that Commissioner Monroe has. But would produce an outcome, is that right?
Or yes, well, it wouldn't necessarily be the first mover, it would be
at the trigger.
The trigger, at a trigger point. So the plan will, I'm confident that the plan would provide an environmental outcome that would satisfy Ms. Banks' concerns. I'm just afraid that it falls on one unfortunate landowner rather than the whole lot sharing it. But that's, I don't necessarily see that as the council's problem in terms of administering its plan.
So if, for instance, we're at, I haven't counted the number of houses on that road, but if we're at 10, then there's some lucky person, if they can get in fast enough, via the 11th and the 12th, it gets novel.
That's right.
That's how it will work.
Yeah, that's right. This happens, this could happen a lot. It could happen tomorrow if somebody asks for an infill, or if they achieves a non-complying consent, would be something to look through if the standards in the subdivision chapter had to go off.
If the zone were to go ahead, given the size of the existing allotments, is it your understanding of the zone that it provides for multiple dwellings on a site without a subdivision first?
Yes, that's possible.
And would one way to avoid the pain and suffering of widening a private lane through a subdivision be to just put a bunch of permitted activity dwellings on each of the sites using the underlying density controls without any trigger at all for...
Making some assumptions here because we're talking about a transport chapter that doesn't quite
exist. And I'm talking about what's in the actual zone, the zone itself. So so let's assume one tried to not do subdivisions specifically because they didn't want to talk to their neighbours about widening a road.
The rule would, you'd be captured by the rule because I think you'd be creating the amount of, because the rule sits in the transport chapter, so you're creating residential units.
Right. So it still captures them,
yes,
even without subdivision.
Yes. So your building consent would become quite expensive because you'd need to seal a road.
On the presumption that the new transport chapter rolls over some similar trigger to the ODP. Understand that. Okay, so that closes that one. Then the other side of the equation is, if it's a private lane, as you say, and whichever way one looks at it, one gets caught having to widen it, which means one has to then start taking a clip off someone's land either side. Are we overthinking it? Is it actually, in reality, the landowner's going to be forced to work together because they can't get each other's land to put the road widening through?
Yes, that's the case at the moment. It's looking at the, if you look at my figure, it doesn't have a name, it's on page 22. The configuration looks like that everybody's property is, and the right of way or the way it's been arranged is that everybody probably has a share and an easement going through their land. rather than it being a dedicated separate access lot. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's the case.
So it could be just based on that the upgrades Ms. Banks feels are necessary to support the zoning would effectively force the landowners to work together so they could actually secure said access legally.
Yes, and at the same time, with my experience of subdivisions, is that the council normally don't interfere too much in the configuration of access allotments and the sort of tenure around them, if they're a separate lot or if they're held in the shared, as a share.
Yep. Okay, I've got no questions, thanks, sir.
Okay. We're ready to move on to Mr. Monroe's submission. Page 24. I don't have any questions.
My only question was just, Mr. Barr, just one to ensure you're satisfied that the purpose of the BRA in terms of the district plan structure is appropriately justified and clearly supported by appropriate policies as to when the council will use it and why.
Yes. And there's this, bearing in mind this was rolled over from the operative plan, but there is support in the urban development chapter for sort of open space or for basically amenity areas and buffer areas at the edges of urban settlements.
So effectively you're satisfied that the BRA has a sound resource management purpose?
Yes.
Okay, I have another question, thanks.
I just had one with relation to the Kirimokal Park Residents Association. I was just wondering if we know what's behind that name. I mean, obviously, I could call myself the Scottish Residents in New Zealand Association.
Yes, well, I think they're appearing on behalf of Mr. Edgar, so we'll find out in more detail who they are.
I suppose that would be a question for a little time. Mm. Thank you.
Right. Next one, Wanaka Central. Well, I see I've withdrawn their request to be heard.
You say you're not clear on whether they seek the BRA to be uplifted, so let's just say for the sake of argument that the submission does not include that, and we're just talking about a rezoning from low density to medium density. What I took from the council's evidence, including your own analysis, was that the main factor against the rezoning was one of an established existing character around it. Is that fair?
Yes, that's one of the reasons.
If one was just for the sake of testing the submission to set aside the significance or the scale of adverse effects likely to result in terms of character and what have you, and just looking to the district plan strategic framework and the zone framework and what it's trying to achieve, would the site otherwise be an appropriate candidate for the medium density zone?
Potentially, in just thinking about some of the others that I've recommended are accepted, it's not that dissimilar, either in geography or location.
Well, what's on my mind while you're mulling it over is the evidence we've been given is that there are areas of the medium density zone that the additional density hasn't been taken up. So first we have to ask ourselves whether in fact potential character effects will be as adverse as maybe is being assessed. And the second, of course, is that through things like the gentle density type provisions proposed in a low density zone,
it might get denser than it currently seems, such that the distinction between the two might not be as apparent, has been assessed. And so just while you're reflecting on that, I think the strength of your view that the land should be kept as low density residential would be a helpful thing for you to clarify.
It's not that strong, is my answer. Looking at the established Kuramoko development, which achieves a relatively compact urban environment for low density residential zoning, if that sort of thing was emulated, then I think the low density residential zone would be appropriate. Having said that though, you know, it could be, as we discussed before, there's no requirement for a minimum, so someone could roll out a subdivision pattern of 800 square metre sites, which would be quite inefficient from the urbanism perspective. So it's not, to be fair, it's not my strongest recommendation to reject. I'm just more worried about the overall coherence, and that it would just be a bubble of medium density residential zoning amidst the low density zone, but often that's what medium density zonings are. It's near to parks, it's near to a popular park, which apparently isn't no longer, which is there's some question marks about that. I won't go there right now. But look, yeah, it's not there.
Okay. So is it fair, without putting words in your mouth, to say that were we to agree with the submission, it would not create an especially problematic contradiction with the overall thrust of your recommendations for Wanaka?
No, and I think that in terms of comparing it to other submissions that I recommend are accepted and rejected, it wouldn't sort of change my fear precedent in terms of changing. I'm suddenly inconsistent with other recommendations.
Okay, well, look, just for the sake of the record and transparency, this might be one, Mr. Chi, where a further site visit after the conclusion of the hearings might be a desirable thing to do. And no other questions?
I think you may already have answered this point in passing, but just for the record, the traffic, the review of traffic 4455, sort of paraphrasing Ms. Banks, I think I discussed with Ms. Banks whether public transport, given that it's non-existent in Wanaka, is really a criteria for anything. And that would suggest, on the face of it, that the balance of considerations are, if anything, positive to the submission.
Yes, it leans quite favourably. Perhaps in hindsight, I leaned a bit heavily on the uncertainty about the building restriction area. I could have been a bit more articulate and separated those in terms of accepting in part, but also came back to overall coherence. This bank's considerations, I think, to do with walking and cycling will hopefully be dealt with through the subdivision chapter and subdivision design guidelines.
Yes. That, because those are interconnection issues within the subdivision, which would clearly be within the subdivision discretion.
Yes. And there's policies, and the guidelines talk about connections between neighbourhoods, so meaning connections to outside the site.
Only one that arises from a discussion
but it keeps coming up, and that's this idea of structure plans. And when one looks at the scale of this submission and the scale of potential development and the magnitude of effects that the council staff identified could occur, it does become one where the not just appeal but possibly practical necessity of some form of structure plan, let's just say it becomes a lot easier to understand the staff comments repeatedly that talk about the desirability of structure plans. So I think what I'm really doing is revisiting the conversation we've had around the extent to which structure plans are not actually mentioned. But you said yesterday, Mr. Barr, you think an informed reading of all the matters outlined in the strategic sections, if one reads it perhaps with the same squint of the eye that you had when you read it, they get led to a structure plan type method. But I wonder whether, partially a question to you and partially in using to the other commissioners, we need to give consideration to a recommendation to the council that it considers some means of variation to more clearly embed what a structure plan might be, when it might be useful, when it might even be required. Would that be something you think reflects the support of structure plans from at least yourself?
Yes, that's fair. If you look at the figure on page 33, I think a structure planning exercise would be essential for us. Area this large. Having said that, though, it would be some exercise to establish a structure plan for that area. But in principle, I don't disagree with your suggestions around the plan being more overt about structure plans. But for this site and for this submission in particular, well,
there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on, yep. And we haven't heard anything else.
No, I've got no questions on the actual conclusions you've reached.
As a trust, well, this actually raises a more general question that maybe I should probably ask you in the context of the strategic chapter, but I'll ask it now because this is where I wrote it by margin. You've in the supplementary bundle, you've given us maps of all of hazard maps of every rezoning application, and you've listed the hazards for each one where identified. It's fair to say that I was I had difficulty at deciphering the maps, but that's another thing. That I have no sense of the seriousness of the hazards. So a general question, are there any zoning applications that you can come bring to mind where the hazard risk is in fact a showstopper? Are there any East Christchurch time bombs in these applications? Or are they all at the margin?
The Wanaka Kiwi Holiday Park, potentially, given its proximity to Stony Creek, but it's been addressed with evidence which the council hasn't disputed. A lot of the liquefaction type information is reasonably up to date. The council relies on it currently for all its subdivision consent applications. We identified it and we didn't really split hairs on that because there's lots of zoned land in terms of the operative and proposed land that contains a liquefaction hazard, but it seems to be reasonably well accepted through the building consent process or through the subdivision consent process that there's engineering technical solutions through foundation design. In terms of any, because the hazards register just tells you there's a hazard. It doesn't distinguish between it being something you wouldn't want to put a house on or not. But that's purposeful because of the council. The hazards register is supported by information from the council, and the Otago Regional Council, where a lot of the information comes from. But essentially, it's a case of if somebody wants to do something on that land, it's up to them to tell the council that what they're doing is appropriate in terms of that risk or how they're going to mitigate the effects of that. So, to answer your question, not really. I mean, obviously, the Makarua Rural Lifestyle Zone is one. But there's provisions in the plan that address that, even though the activity status is controlled. And in terms of other hazards, I mean, there's a relatively new natural hazard issue, which isn't necessarily identified on the register, but that's the fire risk associated with building in rural areas, and more in particular this case, and on the back of Mount Iron, but the council hasn't been able to call any expert evidence to support their case, aside from providing generic information that's available.
So the answer is not really.
Right, sorry, it's a bit long. And I'm not qualified to tell you that one risk is worse than the other. That would be purely anecdotal.
Not really, but in terms of the evidence the council team collectively are providing to us, I think it's fair to say that you haven't drawn our attention to any particular hazard risk that would suggest in itself, of and in itself, that any rezoning application should be rejected.
That's correct.
Sorry, that was very much a cross-examination question. I should have framed that rather better.
Sorry?
I was apologising. That was a cross-examination question on the eve of lunch. I should have framed it better.
It's something we're quite used to in Christchurch from the panel.
I'm glad I missed it completely.
Well, on that note, we'll adjourn for lunch. Back at 2. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman.